Hi people, welcome to the podcast, and today I'm going to talk about the writing of Into the Fire. Not exactly what the book is about, but enough to give you a flavour, and to show how it came to be the book that I wrote when I wrote it, the kind of apex of the writing apprenticeship so far, given that writing is always an apprenticeship that never ends. So if we go back to the start, I was a vet at Cambridge Vet School. I was teaching clinical anaesthesia, which I loved, and to be honest, if it had been an open position, tenure track, where I could have stayed forever, I probably would have stayed forever. I would still be there, knocking out German shepherds to have total hip replacements, and bulldogs to have their airways opened up, sorting out all of the issues that pedigree breeding creates in the dog population these days. But it wasn't open. And I got to the end of it, and I was looking at doing a PhD and heading off into research, and it wasn't really what I wanted to do. And I'd started doing the shamanic work by then, and my dreams and my journeys were pointing towards much more of a creative life. But I had no idea what kind of creativity. I was working 12, 14-hour days, 7-day week. There wasn't room for much creativity. So I started writing, because I had this bizarre, naive idea that because I spent my childhood lost in books and reading and reading and reading and reading, therefore I was going to be able to write. And of course that's not true. And if anybody had told me how hard it was, or how incredibly unlikely it was that I would ever be published, I don't think I'd have ever started. But nobody did. And I did go on writing courses. I am the only person in the entire world who has played Dungeons and Dragons with Faye Weldon and Terry Pratchett. Okay, so we're going to go back and do that bit again. I am the only person in the entire world who's played Dungeons and Dragons with Faye Weldon and Terry Pratchett. I went on 2 writing courses a year apart, and I had my Dungeons and Dragons dice with me, obviously, like you do, and we each played on the Friday night, the last night. But they taught me, before the Dungeons and Dragons, really, really useful stuff. Faye Weldon said, find your voice, and I didn't even know what a voice was, but she showed me what it was and she showed me how to find it, which was absolutely priceless. And Terry Pratchett said, this book will be published if you get rid of certain bits of it. And he was right. That was Hen's Teeth, and it was published, and it went on to be shortlisted for the Orange Prize, which was completely... I didn't make the most of that at all. I thought everybody's books were shortlisted for major literary prizes. And I was still working at the vet school, and I went into work, and, you know, guys, it's been shortlisted, and nobody batted an eyelid, and we went on with the orthopaedics list. So I really didn't make the most of it. But it got me writing, and it got me published. And because of the Orange Prize, it got me to a major publisher. And it was a step from there to writing a standalone, which was more of a thriller, certainly more of a proper considered thriller, because I'd been talking to people at crime conventions. I had ideas then of where we could push the genre that it hadn't already gone, rather than writing my ideas of how to write what was already there. So No Good Deed was, at the time, pushing as many boundaries as I knew how to push. And then, as I've described in Finding the Song of the Stones, I wrote the Boudicca series. And I got to the end of those, and I still wanted to know where the characters went. And so I had a quick skip out and wrote the Crystal Skull, and then I wrote the Rome series, which followed some of the surviving characters from Boudicca into first century Rome, and looked at all of the events that were happening then. Not all of them. The ones that were exciting to me that were happening then. And I got to write spy thrillers, which I'd always wanted to write. It meant I could read the whole of Le Carré, I could read Kim, I could read all of the hook, line, sinker, amazing spy thrillers, and tell myself I was working. And then look at what I could do with that genre and push the boundaries. Because there are things that you can do in first century Rome that you're never going to be able to do in 20th century or 21st century Britain. So I had a lot of fun, and I learned a lot about writing. I'd written by then first person, third person, past tense, present tense, multiple third person in the present tense, and gone back to first person in The Eagle of the Twelfth. So I'd been experimenting with voices and narrative styles. And I got to the end of that, and I wanted to do something different. And I'd read a long time ago a newspaper article about Joan of Arc. And I'd written Boudicca. Of course I knew about Joan of Arc. Women warriors were being thrown at me, left, right and centre. Everybody thought that she was the next obvious person to do. But I didn't know enough detail except to know that the story that we had been told was plainly false. I knew enough of it to know that it was fiction. I didn't know enough of it to know how to find out what might be true. And I read an article in the Indy which described a Ukrainian orthopaedic surgeon who'd been invited into France because he was an expert in building faces on skulls. And they invited him in to build the face of Saint Bernard. And while he was there, they offered him a look at the tomb of Louis XI, or at least the contents of the tomb of Louis XI, because the French have had a lot of revolutions. And the things that the guys with the hatchets and the mallets do when they turn up is that they smash the tombs, which once you've seen them is not altogether surprising. They are absolutely exercises in utter bad taste. But they go, the priests and the monks rescue the things inside, the precious things, the bones, and when the revolution's over, they build another ghastly monstrosity of a tomb with cherubs all over it and put the bones back in again, or somewhere nearby. And so, we think of a tomb as having a person in it. Louis XI's tomb has seven individuals in it. It's got the king, it's got his queen who died in childbirth, early 30s. She was a very frail woman, very small, very bird-like bones. This orthopaedic surgeon identified those two, and he identified four other men who were knights, probably, who had injuries sustained in combat, who had obviously somehow gained the honour of being buried with the king. And, according to the article, he also, the seventh skeleton, he said, was of a woman who had died in her late 50s or early 60s, and, he said, she had ridden a war horse in full armour from a very early age, because if you wear 60 pound of plate armour before your growth plates close, it changes the way that your bones develop. And there are lesions that knights carry, their knees and their hips. If you're riding a horse, a big heavy horse, for most of your life, it changes your skeleton. And he said, this is the name of the individual, which I'm not going to tell you because you can read the book, and this is Joan of Arc. And the French closed the tomb and they threw him out of France. And I read that and I thought, okay, I can run with this one. This looks plausible. And the more I looked into it, the more I looked into the history of what this woman actually did, the more it seemed not only plausible, but it was the only possible answer. We'll take a little bit of a look at Joan of Arc. I'm not going to talk you through the whole book, obviously, but and somewhere else, I will talk about why she was a horsewoman. This woman had been trained not only to ride, but to appreciate horse flesh from a very early age. Just one anecdote. There was a bishop of somewhere who, when she arrived on the scene claiming she was from God, he gave her a horse. And later, at her trial, one of the things that came up was how upset he was that she sold the horse on because it actually wasn't a very good horse. And I absolutely don't believe that a peasant girl coming out of nowhere at the age of 17 has an eye for horse flesh to know well enough that when a bishop has given her a horse, it's actually not a horse worth keeping. That's a small thing. She did a lot of stuff where she needed to be a very, very good rider, and not only a rider, but a trained knight. She had brilliant military strategy. She did a lot of things that other people were not doing at the time, and partly the reason they weren't doing them was that we're talking 14, 15 years after Agincourt. And the thing about Agincourt is that the French lost the flower of their knighthood. Anybody who was any good, the people who enjoyed being knights, the men who had trained from when they were 7 years old to when they were 21, just to be knights, that's what noblemen did with their sons. They trained them to be knights. And the ones who were good were very, very good. And they enjoyed it. They went round the tournament circuit all year, challenging other knights. If there wasn't a war going on, that's what you did. You went out and you challenged your fellow knights. And even in wars, there were rules of war where the knights fought other knights. And Henry V broke those rules of war. And his archers absolutely annihilated the knighthood of France. And so by the time Joan came along, anyone who was any good was either dead or in prison in England. The people who were left behind had either been too young at the time of Agincourt to fight, or they didn't want to fight at Agincourt. And that was a particular kind of person. So she turns up and she has brilliant military strategy. She understands the use of guns. She understands the trajectory of guns. She has ideas of how to fight that people have not been producing for quite a while. And at the end, when she'd fallen out with the king, when he'd placed her under virtual house arrest, she escaped and she became a mercenary captain. She had 200 Piedmontese mercenaries who had come specifically to fight with her. And she had several hundred French men-at-arms who had also come to fight with her. And you don't do that if you're a mercenary, unless you're fighting under somebody who can fight at least as well as you can, and you believe is going to lead you to riches and victory. So this woman wasn't a fainting saint. She wasn't somebody who saw visions of angels and saints. She didn't mention angels and saints at all, not once in any bit of her recorded speech or any of her letters, until after she had been captured by the English. And even then, not until actually she was brought to Rouen and put on trial, when she's got 40 or 50 men of the cloth trying to establish that the visions she had were not from God. They did not ask her how she learned to write. They didn't ask her how she learned to fight. They didn't ask her about the field of Montepulciano, where she rode out ahead of the French army and challenged the flower of English knighthood to battle, and not one of them would come out and face her. They didn't ask any of that. All they wanted to do was to prove that her visions, her counsel, as she called it, was not the voice of God. And I'm not sure how often she had said that it was in the early days. In the early days, she said, "Our Father in Heaven," when she was talking to the king. Once in a while, she called him Messire, which is what a squire calls her knight. And "Our Father in Heaven," "My Father in Heaven," had made her promise to come to France and do the things that she did. Raise the siege of Orléans. Get the king anointed. She was supposed to try and get Charles of Orléans, who was in captivity and was the best knight of his age, unquestionably, out of captivity, to ransom him somehow. But when the English didn't, she changed her tactics and she went for Paris. And the only reason she wasn't able to take Paris was that the king and his advisers delayed and delayed and delayed. From July through to September, they prevaricated. And even in September, when they allowed her to assault it, and she might have gone ahead, they pulled the army out. So she was undermined by her own side from the beginning. But she was a very good warrior, a very good rider, a woman with very astute military tactics, and she was not that which we have been told she was. And so in the basis of that was a novel that I could write. I could look at who was this woman, and I could look at it from the perspective of an English man-at-arms, because there will have been those on the English side who did not believe the God stuff, but also didn't believe the English words, which at her trial, when she was convicted, she was called Jeanne d'Arc, the fiend who consorted with the maid. No, we're going to go back over that, Faith. There are going to be those on the English side who didn't believe the God stuff, but also didn't believe the devil stuff. Because the English line always was, right at the end, even at her trial, she was Jeanne d'Arc, who consorted with the fiend that called itself the maid. It's a kind of displacement. The girl that they interviewed, the girl that they held captive, the girl that they finally burned, as far as they were concerned, was not the one that had ridden against them, because girls couldn't do that. They burned her in the end because she was wearing doublet and hose, men's clothes, never mind a suit of armour, riding a war horse, taking swords from people and using them in battle. They could not get their heads around that. But there will have been some on the English side who could see that and could see what was happening, and it will have been in their interest to actually establish the truth. So I have Thomas de Seagrave, Thomas Rusbeard, who is part English, part French, who comes from the English side, from Bedford, who was the regent, to come and find out the truth about this woman. And that gives me my historical narrative. But through it, because I came from a background of writing contemporary thrillers, and because actually when you've written in first century Rome long enough, there's a point where you want the texts and the emails and computers and cars and light switches and modern language and women who can do things without having to find an excuse why they're able to do them. And so, oh look, the cat's come. Hello, love. No, you don't really want to. And so, okay, we will have a brief pause while we introduce you. Who's this? This is Squirrel. Say hello to Squirrel. Squirrel, go away. Where was I? I was back in modern day France, because when the Ukrainian orthopedic surgeon said, "This is Joan of Arc," what they did was close the tomb and they threw him out of France. Joan of Arc was only canonised in the 1920s, but she's huge in France. She's a big, big conceptual figure. All of the political spectrum, from the right to the left, all take her as their emblem, as their icon, particularly the far right. And so it wasn't hard at all to imagine a contemporary thriller set right up to modern date. I wrote this in 2012, 2013. It's set in 2014, so it was set ahead of the time when I was actually writing it. To look at what might happen in France if somebody who wasn't a Ukrainian surgeon that you could throw out came along and said, I know who Joan of Arc really was. And it's not the person that you're using as your figurehead. It's not the person you're trying to recreate as part of your political strategy. It's not any of these things. And so we have Inès Picot, who is my French police captain. And we start out with her at a fire, one of a series of fires that's been lit in Orléans. But this time, what's different with this fire is that there's a body in the fire. And she has to work out why the body is in the fire, who the body is in the fire, and then how that relates to what's going on in her city and how the echoes of the past are coming forward into the present. And as a writer, to be able to take both of those strands, the contemporary, sharp, fast, gritty thriller, and the passion and power of the medieval world, which was quite different in so many ways from ours, and to be able to weave those together to create a single narrative whole, has felt like the culmination of the apprenticeship of the early thrillers and later of Boudicca and the Rome series, and it was so much fun. So I hope you have fun reading it, and if you do, then you need to tell me. There will be comments somewhere, or come onto Facebook, or come onto Twitter, or email me. Let me know what you think of it. And meanwhile, we'll go on to another podcast. Thank you.